to children, or to anybody for that matter, than to ignore them as if they didn't exist. Well, I made my amends to those boys, and I'll tell you that when my first grandson was born, and it's been 11 years now, but when he was born, when he was 3 months old, my oldest son called up and said, "Would you mind babysitting Carter?" And I said, it would be my honor, be my pleasure. And I was Carter's first babysitter, and I gave him his first bottle. My relationship with his has changed. We're about to go visit my son, my youngest son, who lives in Huntington. You see, it's no longer yours, mine, and ours. It's no longer my stepson's, but they're my son's. He lives out in Huntington Station, and we're going to go visit him and my two grandkids. They adore us. Every one of our grandkids absolutely adores us. You know, they've never seen us crazy. Really. They've never seen me yelling, and they've never seen us crazy. What a deal is that? And they think we're the best. You know, they call their other grandparents Grandma this and, you know, Grandma that by their first name. And, you know, and we're just Grandma and Grandpa. We're just Grandma and Grandpa. And they just fill our lives. My relationship with Tom is, well, I can't even tell you. It's like black and white. There was a time that I didn't know if I loved him. I had very little respect, if any, for him. And I'm sure it went the other way. You know, how can you respect somebody if you don't even think you like him? And today I really like him. Today I enjoy him. I love him. And I have tremendous respect for him. I have tremendous respect for his sobriety. I have tremendous respect for his program and what he does to help people. And that's a far cry from what we had before. Far cry. People often ask us, how'd you two stay together? I think we were just too sick to grow apart. You know? It just, we didn't have the effort. We didn't have the energy to split up. You know, that's how sick we were. That's how sick we were. And I think God has used that. And here we are. And I'm happy. I'm happy. My, I'll tell you this little story, I suppose. I went to Catholic girls' school from up until through seventh grade. And at this school, I went to school with the daughters of attorneys and doctors, and it was a very prestigious school. I mean, Santa Fe is a small place, but that was the prestigious school. There was a girls' school and a boys' school. And the governors, if they had daughters, their daughters went to school there also. Well, my father drank. He drank. My earliest memory of my father was when I was about 5 years old. My mother was ironing one night, and next thing I knew, my mother was against the wall. My father was holding her, and he had an iron within about 4 inches from her face. Next thing I know, we're leaving the house, going to stay at my aunt's house. And that's my first memory. So I'm a Catholic girls' school. My father's a construction worker. He'd been that up until I was about 6 years old in girls' school, and then he switched. He became an employee of the federal government, the General Services Department, and he was a security guard and a maintenance man at the U.S. Post Office in our little town. I thought I had the wrong dad. I thought I was supposed to have a father that was an attorney or a doctor or something important. Never once did it occur to me that Mom and Dad were working as hard as they could to give me the best education that they could. They worked hard. They were hard-working people, And they loved me so much that they wanted me to have the best education I could. I was such a little shit. I was just a brat. You know, I was selfish and self-centered from the get-go. And I had the wrong papa. Well, I found myself pregnant my senior year of high school. And got married. I mean, this was 1971, and I guess that's all I knew to do. And so my father and I are standing at the rear of the church just before the marriage ceremony is to take place. And he said, when we get to the altar, he said, I want to hug you and kiss you before I turn you over to your husband-to-be. I said, okay, Dad. I said, okay, Dad, without having any intention of letting that happen. Now, I can't tell you why, you know. Was it because I thought I should have a different father and I was ashamed of what my dad did, or was it because I remembered being little and seeing my dad drunk with his face, you know, in his food and going to the store and people saying to me, saw your dad out in the front porch, and in Spanish they'd say to me, estaba en la buena, which means he was feeling no pain. He was loaded, you know, more or less. And I'd say, I'd laugh, and I'd say, yeah, I know. And they'd laugh, and, you know, I'd pretend it didn't hurt. But it hurt. It was very painful. I didn't want anybody laughing at my dad. I didn't want anybody laughing at my family. It wasn't funny. But I laughed so that you couldn't see the pain, so that you didn't know I'd hurt. So we get to the altar, and I immediately turn away from my father. Thanks, honey. And we go on with the service. After the reception was over and we're going home, you know, at some point my dad turns to me and he said, you must be very ashamed of me. I said, why do you say that, Dad? And he said, well, you didn't let me hug you and you didn't let me kiss you. I said, oh, no, Dad. I said, I forgot. Alcoholics don't hold the market on lies, on selfishness and self-centeredness. Myself as a family member, I'm right there with you. Full of lies, full of deception. So the day came when I realized I had to make amends to my father. Talked to my sponsor and she said, you're not going to go and tell your father that you were ashamed of him. She says, can you imagine how that would make him feel? Cripple him. He'd be devastated. I said, so what do I do? And she said, you know what you stole from your father? I said, well, and I thought about it, you know, and to tell you the truth, it's really over time, that it's hit me more and more as to what I really did to my father and what I stole from him. And I realized that what I'd stolen from my father was my love. I didn't give him my love. I didn't give him my time. I didn't give him my attention, and most of all, I didn't give him my respect. Bless you. He deserved all that. He deserved all that as my father, absolutely, but also as a child of God, just plain a child of God. So what I started to do was I would go into my parents' house after work or on the weekends, and I'd go and find my father, and I'd sit down with him. And I'd ask him, how you doing, Dad? What'd you do today? And I didn't rush it. Well, that's not entirely true. At first I did. You know, at first I just, you know, went through the motions. But after some time, I found myself sitting there with him more and more and truly giving him my time, my attention, my respect. And I found myself really being interested in what he had to say and what he did. Little by little, I found myself giving him hugs. Little by little, I found myself kissing him on the cheek. Little by little, I found myself teasing him, rubbing that little bald spot he had on the back of his head. my relationship with my dad began to change. He started telling me how much he loved me. Before we'd go someplace, he'd come over to the house and would say, "I just came to say bye and I love you." And he'd say bye and he loved Tom. Oh God, he loved Tom. And three years ago, he was in the hospital, and I was with him. And my sponsor had come to visit. She'd just gotten in on the day he had surgery. We'd planned a party that night, and all my sponsees, Tom's sponsees, people we knew in the program were coming to the house, and I was going to leave the hospital because Dad was doing okay. And I came to realize that Dad wasn't in a position where he could self-administer his pain medication. And I stopped for a minute, and I did what I was taught to do, which is to pause and ask God for right thought and action and the power to carry it out. And it came to me, you can't go home. If you go home and you leave your father here, you won't sleep tonight. And so I stayed, and it was the right thing to do. At the same time, my dad ended up, a week later, having an infection that they had to lance, where he had the IVs, and he went into shock, and he nearly died that day. And the fear I saw in my dad as his fever shot up to 107 within, seconds, literally, he was scared to death. And he said afterwards, after we, got him down and got him taken care of, he said, "I think I'd have died if it hadn't been for you." And I minimized it. And I said, "Oh, no, Dad, it's no big deal." Because I couldn't stand the pain of what might have happened, of how I might have felt if he'd have gone. Long story short, a couple of years later, last spring, he was starting, in 05, he was starting to lose weight. And I saw it, we both saw it, but I really didn't want to, I can still go into denial. And I didn't want to think that there was anything wrong with my dad. Healthy man, 79 years old, and he's still working with Tom doing construction. Tom, he'd be up on the roofs or he'd be up on scaffolds and ladders, and I'd say, "Tom, you can't have him do that. What are you doing? If he falls, he's going to get hurt." And he says, "I'm not telling him that." He says, "You tell him. I'm not telling him." And I would say, "Dad, you better not do that. You be careful." And he'd just kind of laugh, and he said, "Okay," and then he'd be back up, And I loved it. Loved working. He'd be up at 5 o'clock in the morning in the summer, working out in the yard, and every Saturday he'd be over at our house taking out the trash. You see, Dad did naturally what I had to come to you to learn. Dad was just a helpful man. Dad just wanted to be of service to his family in any way he could. Every morning when I was a kid, every morning, he would make breakfast. And I'm not talking cereal. I'm talking full breakfast. Full breakfast. And when I was talking with my dad about this a couple of months ago, he didn't even remember. That's just the kind of man he was. He was not the kind of man to keep score. He truly was not. And my dad loved to drink. And he drank. And his drinking affected me. And I watched his drinking affect my mother. So anyway, he kept losing weight, and we kept going to the doctor. Last summer, I'd go with him. And finally, in October, we found out what was wrong with him after several misdiagnoses. And he had prostate cancer that had metastasized in his lungs and in his bones, and he was breaking bones. We couldn't figure out why. Finally, we found out why. And, we did the deal. We did the treatment. I asked the doctor, "How long does he have?" And she says, "Well, if the treatment doesn't work, he's got 2 months. If it works, he might have, a couple of years, maybe 5. That's stretching it, but might have 5. He was doing good. February, March, he was doing good. He was doing great, and I thought, man, you know, this is going to be okay. Not that he'd be healed, but he'd be okay. And he was okay. And then he started getting sick, and then May, he broke an arm because his bones were so brittle from the cancer. He broke an arm just getting up, just snapped in half. And his PSA scores began going up, doubling, and his blood counts were lowered. And end of June, he asked me a question. He said, when's your next trip? When do you have your next trip scheduled? And I said, well, Dad, we have something coming up in beginning of August in New York. And I said, we have something in July up in Colorado. I said, but that can all be changed. See, that can all be changed. I said, don't give it a second thought. Because I could see that he was needing more and more care. About a week after that, he fell. He fell twice the same night. And then 2 days later, he fell again, and we realized that we couldn't leave him alone. Now, my mom's still alive, but she's 80. You know, she's about to be 81, and she couldn't do anything to help him. And she didn't want to. My mom didn't want him at home. She wanted him away at a nursing home because it was too painful for her to watch him. She just couldn't stand the pain. My brother, who was 5 years younger than me, passed away 19 years ago. She'd seen two of her sisters die. She had a brother that she lost. A lot of losses in her life, and she just couldn't deal with it. Couldn't deal with it. And I couldn't stand the idea of putting my father in a nursing home. I just couldn't bear it. So I and my youngest daughter primarily, you know, would spend the night there. And finally my Tom and my youngest daughter and her husband took a trip, and I realized, you know what, I can't do this. I need some help. So there's a couple of guys in the program who did elderly care. And I asked them if they would come. So I had 4 nights a week, I had them come and help. It was quick after that. I started saying a prayer. And the prayer I started saying was, God, this is really tough on my dad. I ask you to please take him home with you and take him quickly. Because this is just killing him by slow, slow measures. It was quick. A week after that, if that long, my dad couldn't get out of bed anymore. And he wanted to get up. You know, he wanted to get up and go to the bathroom. The idea of staying in bed with a diaper on, just, it's not my dad. And so we went from me helping him for a month, shuffling from his wheelchair into bed to the bathroom, back again, to changing his diaper. Now here's the miracle of this. Here's what I really want to tell you about. I think I got to 12-step my dad. Not into Alcoholics Anonymous, not into Al-Anon, but 12-step him to a power that he could believe in and who would receive him with open arms. And here's what I mean. Little by little, I started to tell him the stories that I told and have told throughout the years about him when I tell my stories. When I come and spend my time with you. I told him about how I told people how he used to make breakfast and about how he'd come and take the trash. And I said to him, you know what, Dad? I tell him that you just naturally did this because that's who you are. And I had to come to Al-Anon to learn how to do that. And then I told him the story. And this is over a period of a few days. I told him the story of how when my brother was in the hospital 19 years ago, and it was the third day he'd been in a coma, and Mom and I walked into his hospital room, and the doctors are working to revive him for about the 20th time. I got my mom by the hand, and I steered her out of his room. And we walked out in the halls and began to walk around the unit of the care unit there, the cardiac unit. And I said to Mom, "Mom, how you doing?" And she said, "Not good." "What's wrong, Mom?" "Well, I'm afraid of where your brother's going to end up." She had the kind of God I had when I got to you. A God that was going to send her son to hell. God was going to send me to hell for the things I'd done. Punishing God. So we walked a little ways. And I said, "You know what, Mom? I said, I think God loves us so much. And he knows what we're going to do because he knows everything way before we do it, before we do anything wrong. And because he loves us so much, before we ever do anything wrong, he forgives us. Long before we do it. Long before we do it." I said, "I don't think God even, you know, holds anything against us." And we walked on a little ways, and my mom all of a sudden stopped, and she turned to me and she said, "Do you really believe this?" Now, as I'm telling my father this story, I could feel the quiet. And I could feel him listening. And by this time, my dad's not responsive. But he's listening. And you can just feel it in the room. You could just feel it like a presence. And he was waiting for the answer. He was waiting for the answer. And I said, "You know what, Dad? I had to really think about this. Because, you know, I wasn't sure if I really believed it or if I was just saying it." Then all of a sudden I realized I really did. Up until that second, they had just been words. But all of a sudden it came to me, "Yeah, I believe it." And as I said that, you could visibly see his face relax. And you could feel that he was beginning to believe what I was saying. I said, "And then, Dad," we kept walking, and Mom, as we got to Carlos's room, my brother's room, she said, "Okay, if God wants him that bad, God can have him." I said, "And that's when the doctor came out and said, 'I'm sorry.'" My mother, who was very, very angry, not only at my father because he was ill and because he was dying, but at me because I wouldn't put him in the rest home, wanted nothing to do with him and wanted very little to do with me during this whole time. I had gotten in morning meditation. There's a chaplet that I like to do, and it's called the Chaplet to St. Michael. And I began to do a novena. And this was before he couldn't move out of bed. And in the novena, I was asking God to, you know, speed his receiving my father. And it was Tuesday morning, and I asked my mom on Tuesday morning if she would like to come in with my daughter and me and say this chaplet. And it was a lot of us there that morning saying the chaplet. Tom was there, my cousin, and a couple of others, and my aunt walked in halfway through, and we all said the chaplet. And this was the first time my mom came into my dad's room and actually just sat there. It wasn't easy for her, but because we were going to pray, she was okay with it. And my sponsor, who I talked to, said, "I want you to do something else." She says, "I want you to say the rosary for divine mercy." And that's a rosary that gets said for people who are dying. And what it's about, and this is paraphrasing, is really to give someone peace and to say that they're forgiven no matter what. So I asked my mom if she'd like to say that, and she said, yeah, but not now. She had to go eat lunch with her brothers and sisters. That's what they do every Wednesday. So she came back Wednesday night, and she said, well, if we're going to do that rosary that you wanted to do, we better do it now. And so we did. And then the next morning, that was Wednesday night. Anyway, we said it a couple of times. But every time we said this, there was a greater peace. And by the end of that rosary, my mom came over to my dad's bedside and put her hand on his arm, which she hadn't done. And Mom and I had a little talk. You see, what I realized was that if I wasn't going to be at peace with myself when my father died, if I didn't sit and have a chat with my mother. And I had to have a chat with my mother that went like this. Mom, I know you're very angry with Dad, but when he's gone, I'm really afraid that you're not going to be at peace and be okay if you don't say something along the lines of you love him or you're sad for him or say something. And she says, well, all I think I can say to him is I'm really sad that you're suffering. And I said, well, that's probably a very good thing to say. And this is making a very long story short. Anyway, Mom stood by Dad's bedside and put her arm on him, her hand on him, and said, I'm really sorry. I'm so sad that you're having a hard time and suffering. So that night, this is the night he passed away. My youngest daughter was supposed to stay with him that night because we were taking turns, and I couldn't go home. I'd been there the night before, even though we had a healthcare worker staying with him, because I didn't want to be gone when he left. And so I set my alarm for every half hour because we're giving him a lot of medication. And my daughter's 27. I don't want her to have to do this. I want to keep my kids from having the pain, you know, I still do. The thing is that you can't be in life. You can't be fully immersed in life if you don't have the pain as well as the joy. Anyway, my alarm finally goes off about 1:30, and I really haven't slept much, and sit by his bed, and I realize that we're coming to the end. And my mom comes in shortly thereafter, and she, you know, asks how he's doing, and I said, Mom, I think he's slowly going out. Anyway, he finally did, and it was the most peaceful death, the most peaceful death, peaceful. Everybody says, what a nice gift you gave your dad. Yeah, I think I did. I really mean it when I say I think I 12-stepped him to a power that could, that he believed could receive him with open, loving arms. I mean, what I've just shared with you is just so minimal in the conversations we had. But I got a gift. I got a gift. I got to care for my father the way he cared for me. And I will tell you that because I cared for him in this manner, I think the pain that I felt when he passed is greater than it would have been had I not done this. But what I got out of it was I got to give my dad a little piece of who I really am. Not just his daughter, but who I am. The person that you guys get to see when I come and share. And I like to think that my mother's in a better place for being able to tell my dad that she was sorry that he was hurting. I'm not the same person that I was when I first walked in here, and I'm not the same person I was when I started this process with my father. And I don't know what that means in my life, and I don't know what that means for who I am or who I'll be, who I'll find myself to be. But I got a sneaking suspicion that I'm going to be a heck of a lot better for it. That my family's going to be a heck of a lot better for it. That when I come and share with you, maybe you'll be a little bit better for it. I have never been able to share who I am and tell my story without just opening my heart and let you see who I am. And it's such a far cry from who I was when I first came to you, because I had myself so locked up tight, so locked up tight, out of my fears. One last little story, one last little amends I want to give you, because there's so many of you who have been through this other little thing. The book says that we will share our darkest past and it might become our greatest asset. And before I'd come into this program, I'd had 3 abortions. Quick transition, huh? And just lost my lens. Swimming in my eye. Oh well. And I had no respect for life by the time I got to you guys. No respect for my life. No respect for his life. No respect for my kids' life. No respect for life, period. I knew at one point, I was never okay with the abortions I had. Never okay with them. That doesn't mean that I think there's a right or wrong for anyone else. I just knew it was against my values. It was against my values. I'd gone to confession, talked to priests. I was never at peace with it. I knew I was going to have to make amends for it. And finally, the day came when I had to do it. And I asked Tom if he'd join me in them. And he said, yeah, because 2 of those were with him. And so we sat down one Sunday morning in our house, in our sunroom. And I had gotten these 7-day candles, and I picked one for each one of the little spirits which I had aborted. And as we sat in prayer and meditation, we finished that, and then I lit the candles. I lit each candle, and I called each little spirit by name, because I knew what their names were, and I knew what their sex was from the very beginning. There was never a doubt in my mind, never a doubt in my mind. And I just talked to him. I just talked to him. And I said, you know, there's not a day hardly that goes by that I don't think about you. And when I think about you, I love children. I love babies. And my arms have longed for you. I've longed to hold you in my arms. And I invited them to be in my house. I said, I welcome you. I want your spirits here with us. Join us in my home. Long story. I also invited my dad's spirit to be with us in our home. So if you see him walking around, don't be surprised. So we did that. Now the next day, I'm going to tell the rest of this and then I'm done. The next day, I'm babysitting my granddaughter, who was 6 months old at the time. And when she was born, by the time she was 2 weeks old, I knew there was something wrong with her eyes. Babies normally focus on your eyes. She couldn't. She'd focus on your she'd like look at you and she'd focus on your hairline. Anyway, so she She has a lot of physical problems and learning disabilities and such, but this day, the next day, I'm babysitting for her. And she and I are sitting in my sunroom and I'm rocking her. See, my sponsor said to me, she said, those little spirits know what they're signed up for. They know it's not their time. And they said, okay, I know I'm going to be around here just for a very short little bit. I agree to that. And then off they go. Wasn't their time. And so I'm rocking her. I'm rocking Kira in my arms. And I'm looking down at her. And all of a sudden, Kira focuses right into my eyes. Her eyes meet my eyes. And I will promise you, this was a physical impossibility for that child. It was not physically possible for her to do that. But it happened. And our eyes locked for easily a full minute. I couldn't dismiss that. See, I come from a belief. I have a belief. This is my belief. My belief. That it was not those times when I aborted them. But I believe that they were meant to come at another time. And I think she is one of those little spirits. Come back. It's my belief. You don't have to believe, but I believe it. This amends stuff for me is powerful. Powerful. All I have to do is be willing and have faith that God's going to get me through the amends and give me what I need to be able to make it. Because you see, I don't have the power to even do that. I don't have the power to make amends. I don't have it in me. I want to run and hide and pretend I didn't hurt you. And they're hard. Amends are the hardest things I've ever had to do in this program. They're also the most free.
Damn. My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. I'll just tell you one little deal, and then maybe we should. I know we should take a break. I think that we've all had things happen to us, spiritual things happen to us that are. They're really extraordinary and are really special. And I'd tell Don certain stories, certain things that had happened to me in sobriety and sometimes, you know, before sobriety, but especially in sobriety when I was tuned into it. And I'd say, you know, Don, is this something like when I speak from the podium, should I be telling this? And a lot of times he'd say, no, that's not one you tell from the podium. Because you'll water it down. It'll lose its energy. It'll lose its power. That's a one-on-one story. You share that with people one-on-one. I listen to them. And she didn't tell you kind of the rest of that story after Vicente died, what happened that night. And I don't know what Don, I was just thinking this, I don't know if Don would say, no, you share that one-on-one, or not, but I'm moved to share it. It's quirky as hell, but you know, my father-in-law Vicente was really old school. He was younger than by about a year than my dad would have been. My dad died in '73 when he was 48. He died here in Manhattan. He was a hard-working alcoholic. That's what he was, and. But Vicente was a year younger than what my father would have been, but he was more, the way he was raised and in the time and place he was raised, he was more like my grandparents. It was more like he'd been born in the late 1800s. And because that's just where they were from. That's how it was in rural northern New Mexico. And he denied himself a lot of stuff, I think. He just did. He just didn't think, I don't know if he thought he was not worth it or whatever, but he just, you know, he was raised dirt poor, and you just didn't ask for much. You know, you just settled for and so it turned out, we found out once he got sick with cancer, that he really liked Johnny Cash a lot, you know. And he never owned a CD player. He owned a radio, but he never owned a CD player. He would have never thought to have gotten himself one, you know. He just, and our daughter Nieves got him a CD player. Well, we all did. We got him a CD player. We were trying to, you know, keep him involved in life. We got him a VCR. He'd never had one of those, you know. And but anyway, we got him a CD player, and Nieves bought him records that she thought he would like, and bought him a bunch of Johnny Cash, like three Johnny Cash records. And he would listen to them, you know, when he was sick. And when we brought hospice in, there was a hospice nurse named Frances who just fell in love with Vicente, like everybody did. And, you know, she told us that a lot of her patients weren't very lovable, but that he really was. And he really was. He was a lovable guy. And so she'd joke with him and talk, and it turned out she liked Johnny Cash a lot, too, and liked country music, you know. And so she'd, you know, talk with him and about different things. And anyway, the night he died, I always say, one alfalfa field away from my in-laws, and Juanita called me when he died, and I came over. I'd been at our house, and she'd been there in the room with him, and I think I told you that, I don't know what we've said so much this weekend, I can't remember what the hell I've said, but maybe repeating myself. But anyway, we washed his body, and we prayed with his body for about 45 minutes or an hour, and which we think is the right thing to do. It's just something that no religion taught us that. That's just what we learned to do. We did it with my mom 2.5 years ago. We had to call Frances, the hospice nurse, and she came and she did the death certificate piece and she did all this. When she walked into the room, she bent over and she kissed Vicente. He was dead, and she kissed him on the cheek, and she said, "Say hi to Johnny Cash." And we thought that was really sweet. And she stayed with us for quite a while, like 2.5 hours, and talked with all of us. Turned out she and I had worked in a treatment center 18 years prior together. Didn't even know each other, you know. And sweet gal. And she just expressed how much she cared for him. She hugged us all when she left. And it was about 5 in the morning when she took off. And she left. And she had said, you know, that Ring of Fire was his favorite song. You know, that's what he really liked. And but he liked all of Johnny Cash. So she left, and, you know, it was kind of peaceful. We were just all kind of hanging out. His sister had come by then, Vicente's sister, Juanita's aunt. And mom was there, and my son-in-law. We were all there. And Frances had left, and 5 minutes after she left, the phone rings, and Nieves goes and answers the phone, and she comes back shaking her head, and she said, Frances got in her car to drive home. She turned on the radio, and Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash was playing. I don't know. Who knows, you know? But I work with a lot of guys, and, you know, what we try to do is keep ourselves open to all possibilities, you know. You know, I've talked about it this weekend. You can really shortchange yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's worlds upon worlds here that are open to us, and I think we tend to diss the power of God, and we shortchange ourselves, you know, by not being awake to this stuff. But I think stuff like that is happening all the time. And And I think, you know, you become sensitive to it. And then Mickey Musset used to say, you're walking in miracle land. You can walk in miracle land. And you can't, you know. And let's take a break for 10 minutes, and then we'll be back.